questions you always had, the answers you were never given, the place to seek the truth. Welcome to Veritas.
Has the Holy Grail of physics finally been discovered? Tonight, join me on a voyage into the depths of elemental consciousness and fundamental reality that will be personally enriching. You will be pushed to think a few big thoughts and ponder a few big ideas, but the conclusions you eventually come away with will be entirely yours. Tonight's guest doesn't want to convince you of anything or persuade you toward a particular point of view. You will be strongly dissuaded from becoming a believer. Data, facts, and measurable results are the exclusive currency upon which his research trades. Greetings to everyone around the world, and a special welcome to all our new Veritas members. I'm your host, Mal Fabregas, thanking you for joining the Veritas family. And if you want to listen to tonight's full interview and hundreds of others, all you have to do is join the Veritas family by subscribing at veritasradio.com. Don't delay. Subscribe today. Try Veritas for 3 months or stay long-term and receive a discount. Just click on the subscribe button for more information. And if you want to get in touch with me, want to be a guest on this radio program, or have a guest suggestion, just click on the contact button of our website at veritasradio.com. I always love to hear from you. Tonight's special guest is Thomas Campbell. Tom began researching altered states of consciousness with Robert Monroe at Monroe Laboratories in the early 1970s, where he and a few others were instrumental in getting Monroe's laboratory for the study of consciousness up and running. Campbell has been experimenting with and exploring the subjective and objective mind ever since. For the past 30 years, Campbell has been focused on scientifically exploring the properties, boundaries, and abilities of consciousness. Presently, and for almost 30 years, he has been at the heart of developing U.S. missile defense systems. He is the author of the My Big Toe trilogy, Awakening, Discovery, and Inner Workings, a trilogy unifying philosophy, physics, and metaphysics. His website is mybigtoe.com, and Thomas Campbell joins us from somewhere in central United States. Hello, Tom, and welcome to Veritas. How are you?
I'm fine, Mel. Thank you very much for inviting me onto your show.
My pleasure. Where exactly are you, by the way?
I am in northern Alabama.
Northern Alabama. Okay. Well, while reading your trilogy, the thought came to mind, Tom, did you connect your mind to the Akashic Records? And it seems to be a massive download. That's how it feels when you're reading your book.
Yeah, I guess that's the good news and bad news, this massive download feeling. Some people have a hard time with that, but the book are fairly intense as far as their information goes. And I call the Akashic Records just databases. They are two databases that are required in order for this reality to function the way it does. And I guess we'll get into that, how this reality functions, a little later. But they are just necessary part of the logic for this reality to exist as it does. And it's no wonder that ancient people found these databases that they could access with their intent, because all you have to do to find them is to explore inner space, that is to explore your consciousness, and you can get the things like Akashic Records or databases or a lot more. Although, I split these databases into the probable future database and then the present and then the past database. But the past database is all the things that could possibly have happened and all the probabilities that they might have happened. As the future probable database is all the things that might happen and that the probability, that they would. So this is a probability-based model. Now, yes, when I was writing the books, I did get some aha moments, which usually occur after you've spent about 3 or 4 days pondering, should I go this way or that way, or how's the best way to answer this? And then while you're thinking about it, the idea just, aha, that's it. And I had plenty of those while I was writing the book. So I count those as downloads. So I guess the answer to your question is yes. I did get a lot of downloads, but Mostly I came up with this book just by looking at my experience in the non-physical, which is, by the time I wrote these books, was like 35 years worth of it, and also my experience in the world of physics, and trying to figure out how those two could, you know, be unified into one model of reality.
When I think of the Akashic Records, in the past I would think maybe that's a New Age concept, very esoteric. But as you said, the ancient ones knew how to tap into it, and I'd like to discuss that later. But first, how did a scientist like you end up in a strange place like this?
Very good question. Well, I took the first step into strangeness while I was in graduate school working on my PhD, and I saw an advertisement for transcendental meditation. And what caught my attention was that you could do more with less sleep, more energy. And graduate students tend to work long hours, at least I did. And that appealed to me. So I took the TM course and found it a very natural fit. And, oh, I say about 3 or 4 months after I started TM, I realized that I could debug my computer code in my mind in a meditation state just by looking at the printout of the transcript in my mind and having an intention that the lines of code that were in error would turn up red instead of black on white like they were normally. And I could just scroll through that computer code and I'd see a red line flash by and I'd stop and back it up, take a look at it. And since I wrote all the code, you know, I was familiar with every line, so I knew just what line that was and why it was there. And then later I'd go into the lab, pull out my 4 boxes of punch cards. See, this is back in the bad old days of computing, and find that card. And sure enough, that's where the semicolon was left off the end of the statement or some other kind of error like that. And that just floored me because that showed me that there was another aspect to reality that I just wasn't familiar with and didn't know, because I could do this not just once like it was luck or twice, but that became my standard way of debugging my code. And it was so much faster than going through all of these cards line by line and trying to find, you know, minuscule errors. Sometimes the error wasn't any more than a fact that the key punch that punched the hole in the card was just a little off. And I'd see that that card had an error in it, but there was no errors in my code. So then I'd go repunch it, and sure enough, it would work then. The hole was just slightly off, so the computer didn't read it properly. So that was my first step into weirdness that gave me a sense of reality being bigger and more interesting than I thought. And I'm a scientist. I'm a physicist. And what physicists do is try to model reality. We mostly do that with mathematics, but that's the name of our game. You know, what is this reality? How does it work? What can you do with it? What are the limitations? So I started to expand my worldview after that happened. And then I got out of graduate school, took a job, and within 3 or 4 months, I ended up going out to Whistlefield Farms to meet one Mr. Robert Monroe, who had written the books Journey Out of Body. And he had just put up a lab for studying consciousness and didn't have any idea really what to do with it. It's one of those, you know, build it and they will come kind of things. And there I was, and a friend of mine who was an electrical engineer was with me and a bunch of other of us from where I worked. And Bob said, well, I'm setting up a lab. Would any of you scientists want to come and work with me on studying consciousness? And, you know, I jumped at the chance, and so did my friend Dennis. And, you know, a month later, there we were up at the lab. We'd be there maybe 3-4 evenings a week. It became like a half-time job, spending like 20 hours a week with Bob Monroe in the lab trying to understand this thing that had happened to Bob Monroe, which was called the out-of-body experience, an OBE. So that's how I got into it. And when Dennis and I first started working with Bob, both of us had this idea, well, if this turns out to be hocus-pocus or nonsense, you know, we'll be out of there in a second. So we were hard cases. We're both, we're very difficult to convince of anything. That's just naturally way that scientists and engineers are. So it was a hard, we were hard cases for Bob, but within a year or so, he had us, he had taught us how to go out of body, how to explore the larger consciousness system on our own pretty much whenever we wanted to. And you can actually still listen to some of these original explorer tapes is what they were called. Bob called us explorers because we were exploring the larger consciousness system. He didn't call it that, but it was just exploring non-physical space, if you will. And they're still available at TMI, the Monroe Institute, online. So that was back in 1972. And once you go down this path, you don't stop and, you know, go backwards or deny it. You can't deny it because it's your own experience. You know, you experienced it. And what we did at the lab was spent most of our time doing things that were evidential because Dennis and I needed to be convinced. So we did remote viewing. We read numbers that Bob would put on a chalkboard after we got into our booths. We did all sorts of experiments. And the results of those experiments told both of us that without a doubt, you know, it was like, 10 or 20,000 to one that what we had done and seen and reported on could have been chance. So we knew it intellectually that it wasn't chance, that something was really happening, but we had no idea what. So it wasn't until maybe 3 years into this process that I finally had the experience that got it from my intellectual knowing that this was real to the gut level experience that this was real. But eventually I got there. And then when I did and understood that there was something real here that a physicist needed to understand, then you're hooked for good. So then I spend the next 35 years trying to figure out how does it work? Why does it work that way? Where did it come from? You know, what's the mechanism that makes it work? And eventually I thought I understood enough of those answers to start writing them down. And that eventually became the book's My Big Toe. So that's kind of how a nice physicist like me ended up in a very strange place like this. I was really just following my experience, following the facts that I was uncovering in two reality frames, one that was non-physical to this one and then this one.
And this is why the book is such an attractive book to read, because, as you said, your day job is designing, developing missiles. You know, how do you create harmony working in that physical world, but then in the evenings you go to this almost like Clark Kent goes into Superman in the evenings, this hidden identity? How do you reconcile both places?
Well, that really wasn't so bad. In general, in my everyday work life, I'm just a physicist, you know, doing physics and doing science. And I keep a low profile. I didn't talk a lot about my other work. So the two actually didn't mix much until later when I was working as a consultant for NASA. And, two of the people that I was working with, two young guys who had actually was a young guy and a young girl, who were assigned to, you know, do programming and other work for me there. They came by one day and said, "Are you the Tom Campbell?" And I said, "Well, I don't know. I'm a Tom Campbell. Who do you have in mind?" And they said, "The one that we heard on Coast to Coast a couple of weeks ago." And I go, okay, you found me out. So that was the first time that my work life and my private life, if you will, actually, came together, and that turned out very well. They were very interested and asked me hundreds of questions, and that turned out fine. It was not a problem at all. But I don't have a problem in working in the – well, of course, I'm retired now. I've been retired for probably 8-10 years. But at that time, I was working first in Army Technical Intelligence, and then I took a job with an engineering company that supported what was then called Star Wars, or something Strategic Defense Initiative is what it was called. You know, now it's a different name, but same organization. Yes, that's the Missile Defense Organization. And what we did was help develop technology to defend this country and allies from nuclear missiles coming in. So it was entirely a defensive job. And the things that we developed, the ideas we came up with, the technology that, that grew up out of this was only suited for defense, not for offense. So the idea of saving a few, what, 100 million lives by destroying a nuclear weapon that was incoming didn't seem like a bad idea, or one that was, inappropriate or immoral. So I didn't have any issues on that standing. It was entirely a defensive endeavor that we were working in. And then after I worked for missile defense for a decade or so, I went to work with NASA, and then I became a consultant and worked in a lot of different companies doing a lot of different things. But all of them tended to be fun because I just did the fun stuff. That was kind of what I do. I specialized in large system analysis, and mainly what people wanted to know is what were the risks in these large systems, what could go wrong, and if it did go wrong, how could you best fix it? What was the probability that it might go wrong? So because the systems were so huge and had so many millions of parts and, thousands of vendors, thousands of interfaces, it was so complex that it was really beyond anybody's understanding of how the thing actually worked as far as the details go. This big picture of the whole system was hard to come by. It was just a bunch of piece parts that met interface specifications, and it all seemed to work. But you see, there would be a little thing that could go wrong here, and maybe it was only a $5 part. And if that went wrong, it affected something else. And if that got affected, that affected something else. And so on, this logic trail would go down through this very complex equipment, and maybe 10 levels later, it would hit something that was very, very important, and the whole thing would blow up and wouldn't work. So those kinds of things just weren't obvious to anybody, and my specialty was trying to find those things out and characterize them as far as how serious, what do you do about it, and what's the probability that it happened.
I remember the movie Armageddon when they say about the space shuttle, this thing is composed of millions of parts produced by the lowest bidder. So it makes your job even more interesting, I guess.
Absolutely. You had to know all of those parts, and they all had to be part of a big computer model. And they all had to have their how long they would last and what made them fail and why would they fail. And if they did, how would they fail and what was dependent on them downstream. So all of that information for this huge system had to be done. And it was a very daunting system. And since I was known in the community to be able to do that, then that's why I became a consultant and just kind of went from place to place doing that sort of thing.
Just a quick parenthesis. Just before I started reading your book, Tom, I was thinking of how most people's attention span has been shortened. And I mentioned this all the time here. Then as I'm reading your preface, you say, quote, most of us are eager to zip past the preliminaries and immediately sink our teeth into, by the way, got to have your permission to read these little excerpts every so often.
Oh, yeah, sure, absolutely.
So zip past the preliminaries and immediately sink our teeth into the meat of the main text. Anticipation and expectation push us to get on with the real thing. We of Western culture are an impatient, goal-oriented people driven toward endpoints. In a rush to the finish line, we take little notice of the journey that gets us there. Such a misappropriation of emphasis often squanders our opportunities because more often than not, the tastiest and most nourishing part of life lies in experiencing the process, not in attaining the goal, unquote. I had to read this, Tom, because this is happening all around us. It's happening to me too. Why do you think we rush to the finish line and miss the journey, which, that's the most important part of all?
Well, it has to do with our culture, the way we see the world. And of course, technology has helped create, the world that we're in now. Technology has changed it dramatically. And when your environment changes, the way you think changes, the way you bring together concepts that make sense to you changes. And before, and by before, I'd say pre-industrial, back in maybe the 1700s, 1800s, people took the time to think about big thoughts. They were not in such a big hurry, but their information was very narrow, was a very small set of information. So I liken that in a metaphor, I think someplace, maybe even in my book, that before we had kind of a knowledge base that was deep, but not very broad. You know, it was like a deep, deep lake, but it wasn't a very wide lake. We were very limited into what we knew and what we understand. And what we did know, we thought about a lot. Today, it's just the opposite. Today, instead of a deep lake that we explore, we live in a global swamp. It's very broad. It's globally broad. We have huge amounts of information and understanding that wasn't available then, but it runs very shallow. We don't really think deep thoughts anymore. We don't see big pictures. We're all wound up in the details of our immediate life and our immediate surroundings, the things we have to get done and when we have to get them done by. And thinking big thoughts and, you know, contemplating big pictures is just not part of our life anymore.
Could it be also that attaining that goal immediately, immediate gratification, gives you that boost of serotonin, which becomes addictive?
Oh, sure. I mean, you know, we always have been attracted to, you know, short-term thinking. You know, what's the saying? You always put your attention on the largest alligator that's closest to you. You know, those things draw your attention first. It used to be that those things weren't so plentiful. Now there's an alligator, you know, seems like, you know, every 10 feet or so. There's so many of them that we have these, so much information, so many things to do, that we have big priority lists. And yes, our attention span has gotten short. We want immediate gratification. And if we don't get that, we move on very quickly without spending a whole lot of time there. That's part of what our technology has done to modify the way we view the world.
I was watching a movie this last weekend from 1982, and the first 5 minutes were the credits. Right now, when you go to the movie theater, it just boom, explosive starts from the very first second. So I wonder sometimes if this is done in order for people to, the new generation, to avoid becoming exposed to all that knowledge that we had in the past, because to them, it's quote unquote boring.
Sure. Sure. That's no doubt the case. You know, we have changed a lot of things the way we used to do them. I homeschooled my children. That's when I first retired from work. I homeschooled them, and I started them out reading classics, you know, reading books that were written into the 1800s, wow. I guess, you know, the classic literature. And they couldn't read it. They didn't have the attention span to actually develop characters and develop a story that didn't have, you know, flashes of light, loud noises, and, you know, action going on, which is right. The way kids see things these days. So reading it was a big problem. They didn't understand the language. They didn't have the vocabulary. And this was language and vocabulary that was commonplace. You know, these books were read by, you know, lots and lots of people in the 1800s. You know, like Dickens, you know, that sort of thing. And today, you try to get somebody under the age of probably 40 or 50 to sit down and read those books, and it's almost impossible. They find them too slow. The plot goes on forever and doesn't do anything, you know, because they're just developing character depth and things. And we don't have the tolerance for that sort of depth anymore. Everything has to be fast and quick and shallow.
And this is why we do things differently. I'm not criticizing any other radio program, but I spend time developing you, the guest, so that the people can get a better perspective of who you are. Now, because your research is so vast, I'm going to use your words. Give the listeners an initial high-altitude peek at the forest before we begin our trek into its depths. Give us some background first, a flyover, to minimize the disorienting effect of totally unfamiliar territory.
Okay. Well, after, like I say, about 35 years of studying consciousness from the inside, mainly my own consciousness, but having Bob Monroe teach me how I could get out in what I call the larger consciousness system, I tried very hard to find ways to do science there, which you can do. You can, if your intent is solid and clear enough, if your mind is not noisy, if you do have a long attention span, you can, after years of practice, produce the exact same altered state and experience. You can, if you will, go to the same place, you know, in the same way and interact doing the same things in exactly the same way. And then you can repeat that and change a variable, and then repeat it again with another change in variable. And eventually, though we're doing this in non-physical space, in consciousness space, in my mind, eventually that process, like any scientific process, you know, leads results of what is affecting what and how does it work. So what I found out was that fundamentally what our reality is information. And that's not too big of a stretch, because if we think, you know, well, what's our reality? Well, it's our sense data. All that is information. You know, we have light that it's, you know, our eyeball, and the lens focuses on the retina, and the retina produces an electrical pulse that runs down the nervous system and so on. This is all just digital information. Digital, I mean, discrete. Discrete chunks of information that are moving around, being stored, being put in patterns and so on. So it's all information. If you took all your sense data away, what would your reality be like? Well, you would just be a point of consciousness floating in a void. You'd see, smell, hear, feel, taste, nothing. But you would be aware that you exist. So that's a state I call point consciousness. So that started me out with the idea that our reality is basically information. And from that, I began to put together a model of how this world and the consciousness world interact with each other with information flow, and came to the conclusion eventually that this is then what is called a virtual reality. Our physical universe is a virtual reality. All that means is it's an information-based reality or a computed reality. Now, back when I came up with those ideas and concepts of this being a virtual reality, myself and Edward Fredkin and maybe three other people in, you know, in either philosophy or science thought that our reality being a virtual reality was a sane idea. Everybody else dismissed that as kind of crazy. But now, today, I'd say 25-30% of all the physicists and physics departments all over this planet think that virtual reality is the right idea. So it's gone from a concept that wasn't even on the charts to one that is probably the fastest growing concept in physics today. And the reason it's like that is not because physicists like the concept. They really don't. They really dislike the concept, because it says that our world is not material based. This is not a materialistic reality. And their whole lives have been based on that fact that it is a materialistic reality. So it's not because they like this idea. It's because their experiments have drugged them kicking and screaming into this conclusion that it is an information-based reality. So that seems now to be a very common idea. So now, to give your listeners a little let's say the quick view over the top of what does that mean? If indeed this is a virtual reality, what does that mean, and what does it say about us?
Like a Matrix, you mean?
Yeah, sort of like the Matrix film. Now, the Matrix film got a lot right, but not all right. But the Matrix film did talk about a virtual reality, a reality that was computed. Okay, if it's going to be computed, if it's going to be information, the information comes from someplace, it has to be computed, and that means there's a computer that creates it. So all virtual realities have similar logic. Okay, they can be different in some aspects, but the basic logic of virtual reality is universal on all virtual reality. So look at a virtual reality that we know. Let's talk about, The Sims, or maybe World of Warcraft, or Minecraft, one of these virtual realities where you log on as the player and you play an avatar, a character. Okay. Now, there's a couple of logical things here to think about. One is that from the avatar's point of view, from the character that you're playing, okay, the computer could not be inside that avatar's reality, right? The avatar's reality is the virtual reality. And the computer that computes that virtual reality has to be outside of the computed reality. Well, that's trivial logic. A computer, you know, a reality can't program itself or compute itself. It has to be done elsewhere. As Dr. Edward Fredkin said, it has to be done in other, someplace other than inside the virtual reality. The second thing is that the player, okay, who's playing the game. Now, the player is the avatar's consciousness. The player makes all the decisions for the avatar. So if it's a Sims character, that Sims character doesn't do anything unless the player indicates what it is he's supposed to do. So this, the player that's logged on, sitting at the computer, makes all the choices for the avatar. That's the job of the avatar's consciousness. So the player's the avatar's consciousness. And we know that the consciousness computes, or let me put it this way. We know that the consciousness has to talk to the computer. It's the consciousness, the player, that sends the computer information. Make my elf, you know, stand up. So that player sends that message by probably his mouse or his joystick up to the computer. The computer takes that and then sends data back to the player's monitor showing that the elf has just stood up and the consequences of him doing that. So if he was in a very a room with a very low ceiling, he might bump his head. So that's the way it works. The consciousness player sends data to the computer. The computer sends data back to the player. That's all that's really going on there. The actual virtual reality is just ones and zeros in a computer, you know, on a hard drive someplace. It's not real at all. So if our reality works just like that, and that's the nature of all virtual realities, then we know that the computer that's computing this has to be someplace other than here. And we know that the consciousness that is playing our body, this character, has to be someplace else other than here and has to be in the same reality as the computer, because the consciousness and the computer talk to each other. They're sending data back and forth. They need to be in the same reality frame. So that gives us an idea of our reality and our consciousness, who we are. We are not our body. We are consciousness. We are individuated units of consciousness, and this body is a computed avatar in a virtual reality. Now that's a big, that's a big step to take, but that is what the physics experiments are telling us. Now they don't go that much detail, but they tell us that this cannot be a material reality, that it must be based on information, and that it is a virtual reality. But from there, now, that's where physics leaves us. But from there, there are just certain logical, you know, things about virtual reality. And that's what I'm explaining. So what it's saying is that our body is the avatar. Our consciousness is the player, and the computer and the player are in the same reality frame that I call the larger consciousness system. Same frame that contains those, databases that we talked about earlier, the Akashic records. Same space that is kind of the source, if you will, of our universe and other universes as well, it turns out. So that's kind of a quick look at, you know, what this reality is. And then we look at ourselves and say, well, what are we doing here? You know, why have this virtual reality? Why is this virtual reality computed? Where does it come from? What's its purpose? And what's our purpose to be here playing it? And it turns out that if you have, as I talk about where does it all start and where does it come from, it gets to a point that you just have one monolithic consciousness. And that monolithic consciousness has one free will, because consciousness and free will are a match set. You can only have consciousness if you have free will. Consciousness makes choices. There's no free will, there's no choices. So there's no consciousness. So this one consciousness needed to grow up, needed to evolve. And the reason that is so is that consciousness itself is an information system. Okay, so this larger consciousness system is a digital information system. It's non-physical from our point of view here, just as the player, you playing the Sims, you are non-physical from the perspective of a Sims character. The Sims avatar lives in a Sims world, and you, the player, are non-physical, and the computer is also non-physical to that player. So this consciousness system would have to be non-physical to us. All right, so we're pieces of this, and the reason we exist is that this larger consciousness system evolves by lowering its entropy. Now, that's a science term that I'll have to explain. Entropy is a measure of disorder. So talking about information, if you have bits, but they're all random, just a field of random bits, you have zero information. Randomness doesn't contain information. If you order some of those bits, even into a very simple pattern, say you just order the bits into up, down, up, down, up, down, how would you predict the next thing? Well, you see the pattern. All the up downs, the last one was a down, so the next one will be an up. You see, patterns contain information. So we have an information system, and if it orders its patterns, it creates information. If it's all random, there is no information. So the system evolves, it grows, it changes, trying to lower its entropy. Entropy being lower means more order, more structure. Okay, entropy being high means more randomness, less information. So it evolves by increasing its information, its order, its functionality. Okay, that's what it has to do. If it doesn't do that, it dissipates and goes away. It just disappears. Well, if you're an information system, that means it dies. So like everything else, it has to evolve just to exist and maintain itself. To do that, it has to lower entropy. And as a monolithic thing, it was limited in just what it could do. There was just this one free will that was making singular choices. So it needed more potential, more ways to grow, more ways to lower entropy. That means more ways to create more order, more structure. And one of the ways it did that, same thing our cells learned to do, because our cells did the same thing in a biological sense, and that is it split itself into pieces so it could interact with those pieces. Now, all the pieces have free will, and you have multiple things interacting with each other in free will. Now, the possibilities and the potential is hugely greater, because it's hard to say what will come out of all of these independent individual things interacting, as opposed to just one thing interacting with itself. So it did that, and it found itself then in a social system. It and a lot of other things had free will. They were all interacting. And how do you evolve? How do you lower entropy in a social system? You lower entropy in a social system through cooperation, caring, working together. That's the low entropy possibility, you know, as we're now, you know, like evolution does, it tries everything, and the stuff that works persists, and the stuff that doesn't dies. So the system learns that through cooperation, it can build these patterns. It can build structure interacting with the other units of consciousness. And to do that, it needs to cooperate. To cooperate, it needs to care about other, not just care about self. The opposite side to that, and I call that the love path, the caring about other. The other possibility is you just care about yourself, and I call that the fear path. And on the fear path, it's all about you. You don't cooperate. You do what is just good for you. And eventually, that works itself into chaos. It works itself into a society where, you know, 5% of the people own 95% of all the worth and value, and most everybody is miserable. That's the end point. And we just can do this. I'm just kind of going over the top. We can do this a lot more detail if you like. So that's why we needed a virtual reality, because these beings needed to cooperate and learn and work together to do things. But it was like a big chat room. They're just consciousness. All they do is communicate with each other. There's no traction there. There's very few consequences. It's hard to learn. It's hard to make good choices. It's hard to cooperate, even if there's no structure, no framework in which to do it in. So the system needed a virtual space, another virtual space, in order for these choices to be more meaningful and to have more significance, more individual and collective significance. So it started with a rule set, created a rule set. It evolved the rule set. It doesn't just make this up. It evolves a rule set, and it starts with initial conditions, and it pushes the run button, and you see how the initial conditions change according to the rule set. And it probably didn't work very well, and you had to say, well, let's tinker with that rule set a little bit, and maybe we'll get something that lasts longer, is more stable. Eventually, you end up with a rule set like ours, which is basically all of what we call science. What we scientists do is dig out the rules of the rule set, like gravity, see, one of the rules of the rule set. So we dig out these rules of the rule set, and that's how we understand the nature of our reality. So eventually the rule set is good enough to produce a stable reality like this one. And when it does, we evolve, dogs and cats and horses and fish and jellyfish and all of that evolved and eventually created avatars in this simulation that had interesting enough choices that consciousness could log on and play these avatars within the constraints of this rule system. So then that's the beginning of us. So why are we here? Why is our reality here? It's because in order to evolve, the system needed more a choice, a larger array, more potential in its choices and in this, with the social system. And why are we here? We're here to learn how to cooperate, to care about each other. We are here to learn how to give, how to love. Because that is the low entropy solution. That is evolution. Learning about fear, or becoming fear rather than becoming love, is the high entropy solution and leads to the death of the system if it doesn't turn around. So that in a very quick nutshell, that I know it sounds like I'm just making this stuff up, but it actually all is very logical. And it doesn't have but two assumptions. And those are that consciousness exists and that evolution exists. Consciousness starts out as a very simple thing, not the system we know. It starts as just an awareness that's capable of being aware of itself, that it can be in one of two states. That's all you need. And that can evolve to be our larger consciousness system. So that's the one over that you asked for. I know it took a long time. It was a pretty long soliloquy here, but that should give your listeners a framework of the kind of reality I'm talking about. Now, one of the interesting things about this framework is that after I wrote my book, I wrote the book to be a theory of consciousness and a theory of reality. It was a model. When I say theory, I mean a model. Okay, now, a model is only as good as it is able to predict correct answers. And an answer is correct if it's verified by experiment. So if the model can explain everything we know and then explain new things that we don't know yet, and then we can show by experiment that those things are true, then it's a good model. If the model doesn't explain things that we know, or, needs lots of assumptions to do that, then it's a bad model. But just two assumptions is a very makes it a very elegant model. And I found out that if you took the exact same logic that described this consciousness system, that you can do much better physics with it. So I started looking at the big mysteries in physics, like why is the speed of light a constant? why do particles, distribute themselves in a double slit experiment as a diffraction pattern when they really shouldn't do that? And all these other mysterious things that have been going on in quantum mechanics and physics now since the 1920s, and there's no explanation for them. Scientists just call it weird science, you know, weird physics. It does strange things. So I'm able to explain all those, and I've come up with an alternate science of quantum mechanics that is not weird science. It's perfectly logical science. And you don't have to just compute it with mathematics. You can look at the logic and predict what's going to happen. And it seems to work all the time. So it gave me a warm feeling that this theory of consciousness, which is the fundamental thing, you see, our physical universe is a derived from that. It's just a virtual thing, that this fundamental reality of consciousness the same theory that explains it explains a lot of other things. It explains theology. It explains metaphysics. It explains most of what people know as the paranormal. It explains relativity, tells why the speed of light's a constant. It explains all those things very logically. So it's so far a pretty good theory, but I'm the first one to tell people, don't believe this. Don't believe the things I'm telling you as true. You have to find them out for yourself. If it's not your experience, it's not your truth. Just hold it as a possibility and think about it, study it, understand it, and then you can come to your own conclusion about whether it meets all of your facts, your experience, because it also explains the subjective world, subjective experience, not just the objective world and objective experience. So that's why it's a big picture theory of everything. It's because it explains consciousness and physics and metaphysics and theology, and it sheds new light on, you know, in psychology and all the other branches of science. Kind of a new shot in the arm when you understand really the nature of our reality and how it works and why it works that way.
You make the comparison of The Sims or War of Warcraft. I wonder how many people watched the movie Avatar and came out with the notion that perhaps our reality works that way. And when you mention digital reality, I think of a beginning and an end because that's the way some of us think in a linear fashion. Is there, or was there, a digital Big Bang?
Yes, you see, there was a digital Big Bang. And the digital Big Bang was when the run button was hit. Now, as I say, the system started out with a set of initial conditions, and those conditions were a ball of plasma, very high pressure, very high temperature. And it started out with a rule set, which is, here is the physics, here is the rules of how this plasma can interact with itself and with, you know, this computed volume that it's going to be let loose in. So you have this thing, it's all in a computer. And we have simulations like that now in computer science departments, you know, all over the place. They'll have initial conditions and rule sets, and they just let it evolve, see how things change according to those rules. And you keep reapplying the rules to the new, you know, changed product. That's actually called a process fractal. And you probably haven't heard that word before. It's one of my own terms that I made up. It's a kind of a new branch of math that you need to understand how this works. But that's exactly what happens. So, yeah, the Big Bang was when the run button was hit and the thing started to compute the results of the rule set constraining the plasma. And eventually you ended up with our universe. So sure, big digital bang, I call it.
Have you ever heard of I'm curious, since we're talking about this, of things manifesting the way they do. Have you ever heard of the Akari insects?
Akari insects?
Yes.
No.
Let me just read this quickly. In 1837, Andrew Cross reported to the London Electrical Society concerning the accidental spontaneous generation of life in the form of Akarus, genus insects while he was conducting experiments on the formation of artificial crystals by means of prolonged exposure to weak electric current. Throughout numerous strict experiments under a wide variety of conditions utterly inimical to life as we know it, the insects continued to manifest. The great Michael Faraday also reported to the Royal Institute that he had replicated the experiments. Soon afterwards, all notice of this phenomenon ceased to be reported, and the matter has not been resolved since then. I always wonder if people like you, scientists like you, could in the 21st century replicate this a third time to see where these insects are coming from.
Well, I would say that it probably would not be able to be replicated the third time. But that does not mean that it wasn't done the first time and replicated, you know, the first time. Those things probably did happen. Remember, this is a virtual reality. In a virtual reality, almost anything is possible. For an example, I remember when my son was probably 9 or 10 and he was playing a thing called Age of Empires. It was a Microsoft game.
Yeah.
And in that, you start as cavemen and you work your way up to a more advanced society. And there's maybe 4 or 5 players. Each one has a group of cavemen that start out, and eventually one of them owns it all. So there's a little strife. They want to take each other's stuff and so on. So that's what makes young boys want to play it. It's a strategy game. And he found a cheat code. And with this cheat code, he could manifest a Mercedes-Benz with a nuclear rocket launcher in the back. And he could aim it at any of his competitors, push a button on his dashboard, and that competitor would go up in a nuclear explosion. And that was a cheat code. So anybody who knew that cheat code could manifest this Mercedes with a nuclear weapons launcher in the back. And it could do that any time in the game that they wanted to. That's just an example of the strange things that can happen in a digital simulation. It's a digital simulation. Anything can be possible. Well, pretty much anything is possible. Now, this system wants us to grow up, wants us to see a bigger picture, wants to get our head up out of the sand and see what is important. And partly to do that, it has to kind of shake us out of our stupor. You know, we tend to go through life like zombies. You know, we don't think a whole lot about what we do. What we do is so automatic that, you know, sometimes you can even get home after driving your car home after work and wonder how you got there. You don't remember the last 5 minutes of the trip. We work on automatic a lot. And our people who market know how to work us very well and how to make us buy their products just based on us being on automatic and the way we respond to things. So part of what the system does to wake people up, and it did a lot of this in that time period. You said 1800s. Is that correct?
Correct. Early 1800s.
Yeah. Around the 1800s. It did a lot of that then because man was coming up to a new vision. He was having, that was the kind of the beginning or maybe the early middle part of the Industrial Revolution. And we were taking a whole new idea about the way the world worked. Newton had told us about a big clockwork universe. And this new thinking, the system wanted to break people into a bigger picture by giving them some interesting experiences about bigger things happening, more to it than just a materialistic machine. And I suspect that these little insects that appeared were just manifestations that the system put there just to create, you know, this eye opener. Oh my God, what's going on? Look at this. And it was also done when somebody of note and credibility tried to reproduce it, and there it was again. And then it kind of disappeared because it had served its purpose as a wake-up call, and it became part of the literature. Today is a different thing. If you look back at the 1800s, you will find that there was lots of things going on in studying the non-physical. There were seances and people who were manifesting, what did they call it? Something plasma. I don't know, things that would come out of their bodies and do things, and there was pictures taken of it and drawings made. And usually it was people with good reputations, scientists and hard-headed intellectuals that came and studied this. And often they verified that what was going on was going on. Those kinds of things did happen, and they were big mysteries. People were levitating, all sorts of things. And then that just disappeared, because as an eye opener and a wake up, reality is not what you think. It's much bigger, has more dimensions than you realize. We changed, and it was no longer profitable to do that sort of thing anymore. Again, I'm cutting a lot of corners. It may not seem so logical, but there's good logic behind this. And in any case, I suspect that if it were done today in a modern laboratory, that it would not show anything. You would not get insects being created. But I am also fairly sure that because of the people who were very reliable made these reports, it did indeed happen then. This is a virtual reality. Those kinds of things can happen. We have things like that happening now that serve as wake-up calls. Things that just happen to individuals will have experiences. You know, a survey of people who said that they had had some sort of paranormal experience turned out to be like 75 to 80% of just random people asked. Said yes, that had happened to them. A lot of these are just wake up, trying to get people to see they live in a bigger picture. That is required before you really get the idea that cooperation and caring and love is the answer. That's part of a big picture viewpoint. Just like we started at the very beginning of this, that people tend to have little pictures now. They're all consumed in the details of their life, and they don't think big thoughts or have big pictures. These kinds of happenings force you to open up and have a bigger picture. Suddenly confronts you personally or in groups, things like crop circles, that sort of thing. Scientists have studied those, and they find that they cannot explain them in normal means. A huge circle covering acres with very precise geometry happens overnight in the dark, and nobody noticed, you know, no lights, no noise. And why? Well, it's just another one of those wake-up calls. It's like today's insects. We don't do the little insects anymore because that wouldn't play well now with us. Science has evolved too much for that to have enough uncertainty to actually take place. Before these things happen, there needs to be enough uncertainty to allow them to happen. That's a thing in the books I call the psi uncertainty principle. And that's part of why some things will happen in the 1800s that aren't likely to happen now. So that's what I think it is. I think it was just a wake-up call that reality is bigger than you thought, and it wouldn't be able to be done anymore. And maybe it wasn't going to be able to be done any more than just those two times that it was done. But you notice it was done with very reputable people who had a lot of sway. They said that that was real. Then you have to believe that that was what they experienced.
To me, all of this and the digital physics is just fascinating. I'm listening to you and I'm just picturing the game of the caveman and then the cheat code and the Mercedes-Benz. To me, is the equivalent of you and I standing in a field in England somewhere and seeing the crop circle being formed, and we have absolutely no idea how that got there. Or let's say you and I are the cavemen, and we see a Mercedes-Benz with a nuclear bomb in the back. How did that get there in the 21st century? How could science not know how these crop circles are formed with the technology and the scientific methodology that we have at our disposal these days?
Yeah, well, that's because they are looking for material causes. And if they can't find a material cause, then they have two possibilities. They can say that obviously it's here, it must have been caused, therefore it has either a material cause that we just don't understand and don't know, you know, which could be, you know, cheated. You know, a bunch of college kids and some farmers came out and did it overnight, right? Yeah, or they would have to admit that materialism does not answer, you know, the question. Materialism is not equipped to come up with an answer. it's outside of the ability of materialism to talk about it. And scientists don't want to go there. Their careers, their whole idea of reality is based on materialism. So the scientists go and study it, and they shake their heads and say, yeah, well, something strange seems to be going on here, but have no idea what. And then they forget about it because it's not profitable to them. You can't write papers about things you don't understand. That's what happened with quantum mechanics in the early 1900s, 1914 up to 1920, 25, where amazing results in experiments happened. They were verified and done again and again, so they were real, and physicists couldn't explain how it could possibly happen. And they could not bring themselves to say that we just don't understand. It's something outside of material reality going on. Though that was obvious, they could not say that because in their minds, everything has to be within, you know, a material universe. This all has to have a material cause. And these didn't. You know, little particles going through slits arranged themselves into a diffraction pattern when there was absolutely no forces acting on them to make them do that. It seemed like magic. So that's why we end up with weird science. It's only weird when you have the wrong perspective. Once you see it from the right perspective, then the weirdness all goes away and it all makes logical sense. But materialism is the wrong perspective.
Now we have to take a one and only break. This is just fascinating. I'm here just paying attention to every word that you're saying, and it's just new to me, a lot of this. When we come back, I'd like to ask you if you think we're living in a Truman Show reality, based on what you said about being avatars and a digital reality. You know, also, what is the theory of everything? In case people wonder, why is it called my big toe? Toe as in theory of everything. How can people buy the My Big Toe trilogy, Tom?
Well, they can go to their local neighborhood bookstore and ask for it. And if they don't have it, they can always order it. Amazon carries it, and that's almost ubiquitous across the world now. Amazon's almost everywhere. You can go to my website, which is www.mybigtoe.com, and you can buy it there. So it's all the usual places, and if you don't want to buy it, it's free on Google Books. So I try to make all of this stuff free. Every talk I give and interviews and lectures and so on all end up on YouTube. So I have like 500 videos on YouTube, and it's all laid out there, and it's all for free.
And I thought I was going to be able to read the entire trilogy, but of course not, because I have to really read in detail. So I was able to read Awakening, which is the first book. So hopefully yes, We'll have you back in the future to continue the rest. But we still have an hour, folks. When we come back, much more with Thomas Campbell. Mel Fabregas from Veritas Radio. Don't go anywhere. Thank you for listening to the first part of this very important Veritas interview. To listen to the rest and all of our archive material, go to the member section or subscribe at veritasradio.com. Don't forget to visit the Veritas store for great products, including pure organic sulfur, rebounders, turmeric, and more. Thank you.